great. It's great to be here. Yeah, the point I think about audiences, multiple audiences, is really kind of the motivating force behind the book. I've been writing principally for an audience of programmers and engineers and techies and so forth for about a dozen years. For a general audience, because it seems to me that life has gotten to the point where the effects, hey Chris, that life has gotten to the point where the effects of the internet are now becoming broadly social enough that there's a general awareness that the internet isn't a decoration on contemporary society, it's a challenge to it. That a society that has an internet is a different kind of society than a society that doesn't, in the same way that a society that has a printing press was a different kind of society than a society that didn't. As I put it in the book, the kind of animating thesis here is that we're living through, in our historical generation, we're living through the largest increase in human expressive capability in history. Right? That's a big claim. There's really only four revolutions that could compete for that. The first one was the printing press and movable type, considered as one broad period of innovation. The second, telegraph and the telephone, again considered as a broad period of innovation. Third is recorded media of all types, first images, then sound, then moving images with sound. And finally was the ability to harness, broadcast, right, to take images and sound. So these are the media revolutions that existed as part of the landscape prior to our historical generation. There's a curious asymmetry to them, which is the ones that create groups don't create two-way communications, and the ones that create two-way communications don't create groups. Right? That either you had something like a magazine or television where the broadcast was from the center to the edge, but the relationship was between producer and consumer, or you had something like the telephone where people could engage in a two-way conversation, but the medium didn't create any kind of group, right? And then there's now, right? And what we've got, as I think David Reed has put it best in his work on group-forming networks, what we've got is a network that is natively good at group-forming. And so although I presented it here, this is Bill Cheswick's great map of the internet, traceroute of the internet, which has been likened to a peacock hitting a windscreen. In fact, this isn't just a fifth revolution. It holds the contents of the previous revolutions, right? Which is to say, we can now distribute music and movies and conversations all in this medium. But the other thing it does is it moves us into a world of two-way groups. Right? If I had to write someday, 30 years from now, when I'm presenting this book, in one bullet point, this is what the bullet point would say. Right? This is in the context of again, the change in our historical generation, this is the big deal, right? That this isn't just a new way of broadcasting information, it isn't just a new way of having two-way conversations, it actually engages groups, right? In this medium, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of assembly are all now the same freedom, right? And that capability, the spread of that capability, is the big deal. So we are, as a species, natively good at group action, right? We make subtle and sophisticated distinctions between being a member of a clique and a cabal and a club. We keep all of this kind of social complexity in our heads about who's angry at whom and who's friends with whom. We track that. We're natively good at that. What our new group-forming tools are doing is providing a kind of prosthetic for that, right? They're providing some kind of extension of that capability. Because prior to having a media that was good at group forming, we ran into this problem at every turn, which is that groups get complicated faster than they get large, right? So if you've got a group of five people, right, there's 10 connections between the five. You could draw it out on a piece of paper if you care about the math. But basically, a clique of people, right, a small size work team, whatever, everybody can know everybody and talk to everybody without too much additional effort. If you double the size of the group, however, you more than quadruple the number of connections, right? So Running a work group of 10 is more than 4 times as complicated as running a work group of 5. Fred Brooks, who wrote a famous book about computer programming called The Mythical Man Month, said famously, adding more software engineers to a late project makes it later. And it makes it later for exactly this reason, which is that although you get extra hands and extra brains, you also get many, many more communications interfaces. And of course, you can keep running this math all the way up the scale. What this means is that there are native disabilities of groups past a certain size, right? That organic, self-forming groups where everybody's talking to everybody else simply break down at large scale, right? The typical answer to that has been to meet larger challenges with some kind of hierarchy. Hierarchy being a really good way to organize a group, keep the connections parsimonious, but make sure the group is all kind of marching in the same direction. What we're seeing now is a set of tools that instead of saying, you get around this problem by simply adopting an alternate way of organizing people, such as hierarchy. We're seeing a set of tools that actually just makes each one of these links very, very easy to produce. And as a result, right, we start to get larger, more effective groups that can nevertheless be relatively ad hoc, relatively lightweight. The social scientist Seb Piquet calls this ridiculously easy group forming, and it has been part of the internet's native repertoire from the earliest days. My vote for original social feature is here, right? So you take a piece of email, right? And email is an incredibly trivial application in one way. It was, in the early days, just a special file transfer program to write a file to a remote machine, just as if you were FTPing something. Except it showed up with somebody else's name on it, and it showed up in a special file called the mail spool that had all the mail in it. It was, interestingly, an afterthought on the original internet. It was not part of what they had sold to ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Association. Once the internet was up and running, however, somebody ported it over from a system at MIT. Within 3 months, email was accounting for 75% of the backbone traffic on the nascent internet, right? This accidental port that hadn't ever been part of the core design turned out to be much more popular than all of this, oh, we can get access to remote computers model that they'd been selling it on. And the reason that happened wasn't that you could send a message to another person, right? We already had a lot of good ways of doing that. And it wasn't even that you could send a message to a lot of people. There were ways of doing that. What really made email take off was this, reply all, right? That was the first social feature, right? That was the first feature that said, actually, everybody in the group can respond to everybody can respond to everybody. Now, this is the platform on which spam is based, right? This is not a completely useful feature. As with anything social, there's upsides and downsides. But reply all was the first time where anybody said the native capabilities of this medium include the social group, and we can make having group conversations as easy as clicking that button. And now, anytime anybody creates an outbound message, right, it is implicitly in the power of all members of that group to turn that into a social function. Now, this is the source of all of those great to unsubscribe, just die conversations you get stuck on where somebody has a particular axe to grind and you can't get yourself off the list. So again, not a perfect solution, but the first social feature. One of the interesting things between 1974 and roughly now, is that although all of the technology has been in place to do this for this period, there has been an enormous social lag, right? That in fact this social capability has not transformed society at anything like the rate at which other kinds of applications have launched. And that's because groups are natively conservative, right? Nobody wants to adopt a communications protocol that actually shuts out certain members of their group. So funnily enough, it wasn't just when some people had access to the network, or even most people, but it is in groups where everyone has access to the network. College students, people in white-collar jobs, where you can now take it absolutely for granted that this stuff is available and start to use it. It is curiously the moment at which the technology becomes boring that the social effects become interesting. To illustrate this in a non-internet context, there's a famous story in my family about my parents' first date. My dad wanted to take my mom to the drive-in, but he didn't have a car, so he borrowed my Uncle Virgil's car and took her to the drive-in in that. And my mom, wanting to impress my dad, ordered the most sophisticated drink on the menu, which was a root beer float. And my mom hates root beer, always has, and proceeded to throw up on the floor of my Uncle Virgil's car. So then my dad had to clean that up, drive her home, clean up the car some more, return it to Virgil with this great apology. And fortunately for me, there was a second date. So what part of that story is about the internal combustion engine? Right? Well, none of it, obviously, on some level, and all of it on another level. Right? No internal combustion engine, no cars, no cars, no dates in cars, no dates in cars, no drive-in movies, and so on. Right? So that's an example of a place where once the technology is sunk deep enough into the culture, the social effects that get built on it simultaneously require the technology and aren't about the technology. Part of the thesis of Here Comes Everybody is that we're at one of those internal combustion moments with the internet, which is you don't have to explain how TCP/IP works in order to understand that a medium that is natively group-forming and ubiquitously available, which is to say both the technological and social affordances are ready, is a medium that's going to change society in a way that the technology alone can't. So I build a ladder in the book of ways in which group effect adds up to something more than just aggregated individual action. And I want to walk through that now. Three of the steps of the ladder are things that I think are widely available in the present day, widely observable in present day culture. The fourth step is something that I think is mainly still in the future, and I'll talk about that at the end. The ladder is sharing, conversation, collaboration, collective action. And the rungs on that ladder are really ways of saying how much does the individual have to work to coordinate their actions with the group. So for sharing, there's very little coordination required. Conversation, some more. Collaboration, obviously more still. And collective action, which is to say, when the fate of the group operates as a whole, requires the greatest degree of individual commitment. So I want to walk through some examples of that and show some of the kinds of things that we can see happening in society today with the assumption that these things are going to be extended as the internet is extended. So, these are the things that I think are broadly observable now. Sharing is the easiest one to see. Here's an example from Delicious. Delicious is the tagging service where you can save URLs and then label them for yourself. Delicious has really only three units in the system, although there are other aspects of the interface. Really, there are URLs, there are users, and then there are tags. Right? And they have so lowered the difficulty of sharing that the social effects created by Delicious are almost an afterthought. Right? That this is what Stowe Boyd calls me first collaboration, which is users are mainly acting out of personal utility, but the social effects are being aggregated out of the large massive links. One of the interesting things about this model is that it reverses the old order of sharing. When groups were difficult to form, you had a world where you would congregate and then you would share. Let's get everybody together who wants to share things and then they can share with one another. What tagging systems do is they reverse that. So now you can share and then aggregate, which is to say you discover who you have things in common with and what you think about those things only after you've done your own work. One of the examples, again, from the again from the book is the mermaid parade in Coney Island. Every first Saturday of every summer, we have this charming little hipster parade around Coney Island. Everybody dresses up in mermaid costumes and walks around, and then tens of thousands of people turn out, including hundreds of amateur photographers. And starting in 2005, when Flickr added tagging, You could suddenly go in and click Mermaid Parade and get all of the aggregate photos of the participating photographers. But those photographers weren't coordinated in advance. In fact, they discovered one another and started riffing on one another's works in subsequent years because they'd already identified themselves from sharing. So sharing has now become a platform for coordination instead of vice versa. And that pattern is probably the most widely distributed now. Certainly everything since Napster, right, it forms this kind of continuity of Napster, Flickr, YouTube, the places where sharing as a platform is already obviously and visibly changing the media landscape. The next rung up the ladder is conversation, which is to say when people are actually synchronizing with one another somewhat. And these aren't absolutely distinct categories. In some cases, you get sharing plus collaboration. So here's an example of something called a community of practice. And a community of practice is where a group of people wants to come together and learn about something together. They want to come together and get better at it. So this is an example of something called high dynamic range photography. I think the screen's a little washed out. You can't see the photo well enough to see what's remarkable about it. But high dynamic range photography is where you take a picture of the same scene at three exposures, and then you use software to pull the brightest bright and the darkest dark and the greenest green and so forth and make one composite picture. In its most practiced form, it hovers someplace between a photograph and a pre-Raphaelite painting. They're really kind of striking images. In the old days, right, something like this would have taken 5 to 7 years to go from a professional photographer has figured out how to do this to the technique is normalized to it goes to photographic magazines and eventually it shows up in popular photography and then people on the street are doing it. With Flickr, it took about 3 months. Because when an HDR photo went up, people would say, how did you do that? Right? How on earth did you accomplish this? Like, I don't have a camera that can do that. Right? And then the takers of the photos would be so delighted to be asked, they would go and post these exegeses of, this is exactly how you do it, this is the software you use, this is the technique. And for this little photo, right, this is the entire page rendered. So you can see, right, the little photo at the top. And then for a while, the conversation is just going on. I don't have a laser pointer, but up at the top, the conversation is just going on. And then people start posting alternate photos, right? So what was a little bit of media sharing now becomes the platform for this community of practice, right? The group gets better together. And high dynamic range photography went from being a couple of interesting little photos on Flickr to something that was well understood, well integrated, and where there were incredible detailed descriptions of how to get started, what to look for, what to do right, and what to do wrong. And the community produced this for themselves. There was no commercial incentive anywhere in sight. This is an example of a pattern that I'm calling every URL is a latent community. Which is to say, in addition to the value of having an individual being exposed to a resource that's available on the internet, there's additional value to be gotten by introducing those users to one another. Now, to the 90th percentile, that's not used, right? Any two people looking at the front page of Google right now don't have that much in common, right? But on Flickr, any two users looking at a high dynamic range photo may also have something to say to one another that creates value. And Flickr has created a world in which sharing plus conversation leaves this residue of instruction that's actually made an incredibly technical subject remarkably accessible in a short period of time. Again, a kind of creation that we had an analog for, but required lots of professional layers, took lots of time, required lots of money, and didn't work either as quickly or critically as well. Right? And this is just one of many. Right? You can see that, in fact, all of these conversations over here have this same characteristic of every URL as a latent community, which is the discussion that goes on around it is about people who've been brought together by the resource, but then start sharing with one another. Right? Now, some of these conversations, right, are just pure conversations. Right? There's not all of these groups are groups that have powerful or important external goals. One of my favorites is Bronze Beta. This is a website for fans of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Now, it's called Bronze Beta because the original site called Bronze, named after a location in the TV show, was going to be canceled. Right? When Warner Brothers was selling Buffy to UPN, One of the things UPN said to the fans was, you know what, we're shutting down this bulletin board. We're not in that business. We're in the television business. And so the fans all kind of panicked, right? They said, oh, you know, we've come to have a great deal of interest and affection in one another, in addition to caring for the TV show. We don't want Bronze to go away. So they took up a collection, and they got enough money to commission new software, which they were then going to move into, like a hermit crab changing shells, right? And one of the things they said to the people designing the new software was, for God's sake, whatever you do, don't give it any features, right? Don't give it any rating and ranking and reputation systems. Don't give it any kind of complicated identity management. We just want the system we used to have, right? And the system we used to have is literally this ugly piece of 1995 style web design, where when you go to Bronze Beta, you could do this right now, when you go to Bronze Beta, what you will see at the very top is a form where you can add your comment. And when you type it and hit submit, your comment goes to the top. There's no threading. There's no alternate conversation. This is it. This is the entire site, right? And yet, right, they not only outlasted the existence of the original site to move to Bronze Beta, like Unitarians, they outlasted the death of their object of veneration, right? They stayed, even after Buffy vanished, right, they've stayed together. And this is what the page looks like now. It goes on and on and on, and then at the very top is this little form you could fill out, and you add your comment. The hilarious thing about the form is the password is optional, right? Everybody else is doing these incredibly beefed up, like, give us your password and your challenge thing. They don't even care. You could go in and invent a username and start posting here tomorrow, right? This whole thing is held together by their affection for one another. And their refusal to have features, I think, was a really savvy move on their part, because they understood that it isn't about the technology past a certain point, right? Once they have simple enough technology that they can actually be hanging out talking to one another, more features are actually kind of a distraction, right? Moving up from conversation to collaboration, there's a quite remarkable community doing anime fan sub, right? This was a group of people who, a little bit like a community of practice, gathered around their shared love of anime, of Japanese animation. But they decided to go one further. It wasn't just about how can we all learn more about anime. They started writing software for themselves to be able to subtitle the anime that they liked and they thought should be imported from Japan to the US. So they would get Japanese anime and then they would create their own version that was available for English users. So this is a really remarkable effort. First of all, multi-platform, including a free BSD port, which is really, that's rare, right? That is a degree of technical devotion that's quite surprising, right? And then they have these pages where they just go through, and you can see it's all the distributor group name and then what the actual movies are. And it's all distributor groups, because this one required division of labor, right? This isn't just like high dynamic range photography where each person is going out with a camera and then has a piece of software. With this one, you've got some people who are translators, some people who are dubbers, some people who are writing the software, some people who are keeping track of what's on offer. And so this actually required teamwork. And this one, you know, teamwork is even more remarkable because, again, there is no commercial motivation here, right? Perhaps even more remarkably, these people were fixing, very self-consciously, a market failure. They said, basically, everybody knows Sailor Moon, right? That's all anybody knows about, because that's what's been brought over. They don't understand that the good stuff is not getting from Japan to the US. We're going to move it over. When the owners of the anime that were translated did their own translation, did their own dubbing, these guys would take theirs down, right? not, they didn't actually want to compete with the people they thought were doing the good animation. They just wanted to fix the market failure. And so they ended up so signaling the high demand for stuff that the American distributors thought was too arcane, that most of this stuff is now in the past, right? That in fact the anime market has opened up, and these groups had a hand in altering the way that the market was looked at, right? So this is an incredible, incredible amount of collaborative effort, including, as I said, writing their own software. And it's not that it has a commercial motivation, and it's also not that it has an anti-commercial motivation. Right? These aren't people who were motivated by sticking it to the man. They really were just motivated by the idea of increasing the accessibility of anime. And their success in doing so kind of put them out of business. They changed the world to be more like what they wanted, and once it changed, right, they could stop doing it. So those three patterns, sharing, conversation, and collaboration, are things that require, in order, more synchronization of the individual with the group. And by the time you get to collaboration, the group is really the unit to which the effort can be ascribed, as with the distributor group. There's a fourth rung in that ladder, which is collective action, and that's what I want to talk about now. Collective action, of all the patterns of group activity that I talk about in the book, collective action is the one that is there are the fewest examples of right now, in part because it's the hardest to get going, and in part because the social support required to sustain it is still being worked out. So I want to tell three stories of collective action and talk a little bit about why it's the rarest pattern so far, but also why I think it's a pattern that we're going to see a lot more of in the future. So here's a plane stuck on the tarmac in the snow. This happened in January of 1999. A Northwest flight was diverted first to Miami, and then the next day it was allowed finally to fly into Detroit. They landed in the afternoon into a snowbound Detroit airport. There was no gate. They're pulled off to the side, and there they sat. Perhaps you've been there. Ran out of food. They ran out of water. The toilet started to clog, then smell, then break, then leak. There were babies crying for hours and hours, 20 degrees below. They land at 2:45 in the afternoon. They finally get off the plane after a passenger calls directory assistance and gets the home phone number of the CEO. And the pilot, on hearing this, summons the passenger to the cockpit. The passenger thinks he's going to be disciplined for calling the CEO at home. The pilot says, "No, you got Dasberg's number, give it to me." The pilot calls the CEO at home, and they finally get into a gate at 9:30 at night, 7.5 hours after they land. Right. The media has a field day with this, needless to say. And there is a general sense that this situation is intolerable and something needs to be done. Right? And then nothing happens. Right? Nothing at all. Northwest just waits it out. Right? There's a class action lawsuit. Lawyers had been running up and down the aisle of the plane collecting signatures. Right? The class action lawsuit is filed. Northwest tries to get it thrown out of court. They can't, so they settle because they desperately don't want the passengers to be given legal rights in court. So they settle the lawsuit out of court. They write some, "Dear irate passenger, we're sorry you're irate." They sign themselves up for a kind of toothless code of conduct for running an airline. And that's it. The whole thing blows over. And they think, okay, great, dodged a bullet. No new rights. And that was the way it was for 8 years. So here's another airplane on the tarmac, stuck, this one in the rain. This is about a year ago Christmas. American Airlines lands a bunch of flights at Dallas on their way to, the flights were actually on their way to Austin, but were diverted because of weather. They run out of food, they run out of water, the toilets clog, then leak, then break. Different babies, same crying, equally horrible situation. 8 hours on the tarmac. And there was a sense after this that something needed to be done. And here's what happened. 8 months later, New York State passes a law implementing a passenger's bill of rights. And it's done. And it's done because New York State has the busiest air traffic space in the nation. And when they change the law in New York, it's basically a national change. So how did that happen, right? What was different between 1999 and 2007? Then in 99, the airlines could just sit tight and the whole thing blows over. And in 2007, it takes less than 8 months to create the very situation that the airlines have been willing to spend millions to avoid. So here's part of what happens, right? Kate Hanna, a real estate agent in Napa Valley, gets off the plane and she is pissed. And you can imagine being in that situation, right? But she decides to do something. And what she decides to do is quite interesting. She goes home and starts Googling for news stories about this event. So someone will write a little 200-word article, oh, the Austin airport says it wasn't its fault, it was the airline's fault, blah, blah, blah. Then the first comment, like you can go find this today if you Google it, the first comment is Kate Hanna's, right? Her comments are often longer than the story she's commenting on. I was on this flight, this is how horrible it was, this is what happened to us. And, right, so far it just sounds like internet kook, right? And then at the end of these comments, she says, if anybody else was on this flight, please contact me. Here's my phone number, here's my email address. So she's co-opted media as a site of information, and she's turned it into a site of coordination. She's actually started canvassing for people to join her movement. And after a few days of this, she's got enough people joining in that she's able to do this, which is to set up a coalition for an airline passenger's bill of rights. She's recruited some people on the flight who are equally angry. She's gotten them to call their congresspeople. She's called her congressperson. And then she puts a little link on here that says, sign our petition. Right? And so you're one click away from saying, yeah, I want a passenger's bill of rights. Tens of thousands of people signing this online petition in a matter of weeks. She's suddenly able to go around to various legislatures' offices and say, this matters, this is a nonpartisan issue. People in your district care about this. Congress watered it down, and it eventually was killed in committee. But that didn't happen in New York State. In New York State, it actually went through. William James, the American philosopher, once said, thinking is for doing, by which he meant we don't have abstract cogitation in order to think kind of airy thoughts. We, in fact, have brains because we're deciding between or preparing for courses of action. What Kate Hanna and the Coalition for the Air Passengers' Rights have shown is something analogous is increasingly true of media, which is that publishing is for acting, right? That when you get a whole group of people, all of whom have the same information, you've actually synchronized them to do something together. Now, it has principally not been media's role to actually act on that synchronization, mainly because they can't, right? The kind of shared awareness produced by a newspaper or a television show is very hard to coordinate, or rather, it used to be. What Hanna and I realized is that if you've got people coming to read something about a coalition for air passengers' rights, you're one click away from having them help you give leverage to change the law. And that kind of change, where media becomes a place where groups can come together and achieve some kind of shared goal rather than just as a source of information, is, I think, it's observable now and it's going to become widespread. So here's a second story about collective action. Again, a very specific one because these examples are few and far between. But you all remember flash mobs, right? The flagpole sitting of 2003, where some synchronized email would go out, let's all get together at the same place, same time, do something mildly funny, right? So flash mobs turned out to have been promulgated by Bill from New York, whose name was on the email. Well, Bill from New York was Bill Wasik of Harper's Magazine. And he conceived of flash mobs as a kind of critique of hipster culture, right? He said basically, I can prove that hipsters are so brain dead that if you tell them that what they're going to do is going to be shocking to the bourgeoisie, they will completely set aside any set of judgment, any kind of judgment they have, and do any damn fool thing you put in a piece of email. Right? And lo and behold, they have pillow fights in downtown Toronto, or 100 people show up at a pigeon, stone ledge in Central Park and start making pigeon noises. Right? So in fact, Wasik demonstrated exactly what he wanted. And these kinds of things spread, right? Eventually, it goes to Toronto, it goes to the UK, it goes to France. And in 2006, it gets to Belarus. Right? So somebody puts up a weblog page in LiveJournal saying, hey, you guys, I know, let's have a flash mob, right? Let's all go to downtown Minsk and we'll walk around October Square eating ice cream. It's what passes for a good time in Minsk, I guess. So here they are, the flower of Minsk, walking around eating ice cream. Right? And this photo stream goes up immediately after the event. The next set of photos, though, unusual in the history of flash mobs, is black-clad secret police dragging those kids bodily out of the square. The problem with the group eating ice cream wasn't the ice cream. It was the group. Lukashenko, who's the leader of Belarus, is the last of the great Eastern European dictators. He stole the election in March of 2006, and then to forestall the kind of problems that they had had in other Eastern European countries, he made it illegal to act in concert in October Square, which is the site of most political protests. So what these kids did is they grabbed the flash mob pattern, which in a U.S. context had been essentially a political mocking of this kind of collective action, and they actually turned it into a successful tool for protest. Because the Lukashenko government can't penetrate the conspiracy, right? The whole thing is being done on a weblog. How much more public could it be, right? And they can't stop the group from entering October Square because they're not a group when they enter October Square, which is, of course, the whole point of the design of flash mobs. So they've managed to provoke the Lukashenko government into reacting in real time, right? And that was part of their goal, right? To create this situation where they can demonstrate that the state is willing to drag these kids out of the square. But it wasn't just to provoke the reaction, it was also to document it. These kids didn't just bring their ice cream to October Square, they brought their cameras, right? And these photos went up because these photos went up online almost immediately. This isn't just an example of media leading to collective action, it's also an example of collective action leading to more media. Right? Because nothing says dictatorship like arresting people for eating ice cream. And they wanted these photos to be widely circulated. Because their theory is that observation by the US and Western Europe will at least moderate what the Lukashenko government is able to do to the opposition. The bug in the system, sadly, is that the West actually cares quite a bit less about dictatorship in Eastern Europe than it used to. But this in any case is their goal. One of the lessons that I took from this is that these kinds of tools are very different when deployed in high or low freedom environments, right? In a high freedom environment, new communications tools tend to be used for entertainment, right? People were tripping over themselves when Twitter launched to denounce it as the most stupidest application ever, right? This is the SMS rebroadcasting service. But Egyptian democracy activists are actually using Twitter to coordinate their actions relative to the authorities. So a big part of how these tools get used actually depends on the political context in which they're operating. And flash mobs, in fact, aren't a permanent critique of bourgeois culture. They're just a critique of that culture in the US. But in the Belarusian context, right, they're actually a really potent way of forcing the state to do something in public that they don't otherwise want to do. And these kids have done several of these. My favorite, actually, is when they said, let's all go down to October Square and walk around smiling at each other. Right? So there's an ontological dilemma for the cops, right? It's, are you smiling because you're a protester, or are you just smiling because you're a regular old non-radicalized citizen? Because if I arrest you for smiling, I'm actually going to push you into the protester camp. And then there's the subtle asterisk of anybody walking around October Square smiling is probably imagining the overthrow of Lukashenko. Here's a third example. This one not in the book, but I'm going to get bored if I do book talks and I only talk about the stuff I've been thinking about for 2 years. So this came to my attention more recently. In 2004, there was a group that ran around Palermo, Italy, putting up stickers one night that said, an entire people that pays the piso, that pays payment money to the mafia, is a people without dignity. Right? Number one news story in the newspapers, television the next day. Right? This is an incredible affront to the mafia's dominance of this economy. And what they seem to have realized, the group that does this is anonymous for obvious and understandable reasons, what they seem to have realized, right, is that their actions can create this kind of media. What they've been doing more recently is reversing that and trying to use the media to create more actions. So after the success of the stickering campaign, they put up a website, audiopiso.it, and they've created an environment in which businesses can stand up together and refuse to pay payment money, refuse to pay the piso. Because, of course, if one business stands up and says, I defy the mafia, not great. Not a great strategy. In fact, that happened a few times in the 90s. The businesses were invariably ruined. In many cases, the person who stood up was killed. But if an entire set of businesses or an entire street stands up, right, then the mafia has a very different kind of problem on their hands. Because they can't go after just one person. And then the Audio Pizzo people realized, we're not just coordinating this previously uncoordinated group of businesses. The people who are ultimately most affected by this are the citizens of Palermo. So they created a search engine, right? And if, as a citizen, you want to say, I am only going to patronize businesses that refuse to engage in this payment money, suddenly it's easier for the citizens to anonymously redirect their business, right? You can also make a credit card donation, right? They even have gone to the point of showing you how to fill out your tax forms to make a nonprofit donation. Right? So this is a case where, by gathering these groups that all have a stake in fighting off the mafia but have no other coordinating site, they've actually created a kind of group action out of making this media available. So here it is. Ridiculously easy group forming improves all of these things. And as I said, sharing, conversation, and collaboration, I think, are all broadly observable and are all moving through the culture. The thing I'm watching out for most in 2008 is an increase in collective action as groups start to take it for granted that they're able to do this, and as individuals become willing to join groups where the fate of the group as a whole becomes important to them. Right? Obviously, everybody who walks with an ice cream cone into October Square understands that they're throwing their lot in with everybody else, right? The Audio Pizzo group understands that they are collectively standing up against the mafia. This is the hardest pattern of all to support, but I think in many ways it will be the most radical for society. So, thanks very much, and let's open it up to questions.